Chapter 5. The Plains of Mengeta. Why must I conquer, you ask? War makes clear. Life or death. Freedom or bondage. War strikes the sediment from the water of life. Triamus the First. Journals and Dialogues. Early summer, 4111, year of the Tusk, near the plains of Mengeta. Neyur had known something was amiss long before sighting the fields of trampled pasture and dead fire pits. Too little smoke on the horizon and too few scavenging birds in the sky. When he mentioned this to Proyas, the prince had blanched, as though he'd confirmed a festering concern. When they crested the last of the hills and saw that only the Conryans and the Nansur remained beneath Asgiliak's walls, Proyas had fallen into an apoplectic fury, fairly shrieking curses as he whipped his horse down the slopes. Neyur, Zynemus, and the other Conryan caste nobles comprising their party chased him all the way to Confis's headquarters, where the exalt general explained, in his infuriatingly glib way, that the morning of the day previous, Coithus Sauban had decided to make the most of Proyas's absence. The Shrial Knights, of course, couldn't lay hoof or boot in the tracks of another when it came to heathen land, and as for Gothjelk, Skeelt, and their barbaric kinsmen, how could they be expected to distinguish fools from wise men, what with all that hair in their eyes?
"Didn't you argue with them?" Proyas had cried. "Didn't you reason?"
"Sauban wasn't interested in reason," Confis replied, speaking as he always did, as though intellectually filing his nails. "He was listening to a louder voice, apparently."
"The god?" Proyas asked.
Confis laughed. "I was going to say greed, but yes, I suppose the god will do. He said your friend, the Prince of Atrathau, had a vision." He glanced at Neyur.
"You mean Kellis?" Proyas cried. "Kellis told him to march?"
"So the man said," Confis replied.
"Such is the madness of the world," his tone added, though his eyes suggested something far different. There was a moment of communal hesitation. Over the past weeks, the Dunyane's name had gathered much weight among the Inrithi, as though it were a rock they held at arm's length. Neyur could see it in their faces, the look of beggars with gold sewn into their hems, or of drunkards with over-shy daughters. What, Neyur wondered, would happen when the rock became too heavy? Afterward, when Proyas confronted the Dunyane at Zynemus's camp, Neyur could only think, "He makes mistakes."
"What did you do?"
Proyas asked the fiend, his voice quavering with rage. Everyone, Serwe, Dinchazes, even that babbling sorcerer and his shrew whore, sat stunned about the evening fire. No one spoke to Kellis that way. No one. Neyur almost cackled aloud.
"What would you have me say?" the Dunyane asked.
"What happened?"
Proyas cried.
"Sauban came to us in the hills," Akamian said quickly, "while you were in Tus—"
"Silence!"
the prince cried, without so much as glancing at the schoolman.
"I have asked you. You're not my better,"
Kellis thundered. All of them, Neyur included, jumped, and not merely in surprise. There was something in his tone, something preternatural. The Dunyane had leapt to his feet, and though a length away, somehow seemed to loom over the Conryan prince. Proyas actually stepped backward. He looked as though he had remembered something unspoken between them.
"You're my peer, Proyas. Do not presume to be more."
From where Neyur stood, the ochre walls and turrets of squat Asgiliak framed the head and shoulders of the two men. Kellis, his trim beard and long hair shining gold in the evening sun, stood a full head taller than the swarthy Conryan prince, but both men emanated grace and potency in equal measure. Proyas had recovered his angry glare.
"What I presume, Kellis, is to be party to all decisions of moment regarding the Holy War."
"I made no decision, you know that. I told Sauban only."
For a fleeting moment, a strange, almost lunatic vulnerability animated his expression. His lips parted. He seemed to look through the Conryan prince.
"Only what?"
The Dunyane's eyes refocused, his stance hardened. Everything about him converged somehow, as though he were somehow more here than anyone else, as though he stood among ghosts.
"He speaks in hidden cues," Neyur reminded himself. "He wars against all of us."
Only what I see, Kellis said.
And just what is it you see?
The words sounded forced. Do you wish to know, Nerse Proyas? Do you really want me to tell you? Now Proyas hesitated. His eyes flickered to those surrounding, fell upon Nayor for a heartbeat, no more. Without expression, he said,
You've doomed us.
Then, turning on his heel, he strode in the direction of his quarters. Afterward, in the stuffy confines of their pavilion, Nayor set upon the Dunyane in Skilvendi, demanding to know what had really happened. Serwe huddled in her watchful little corner, like a puppy beaten by two masters. I said what I said to secure our position, Kellis asserted, his voice passionless, bottomless, the way it always was when he affected to reveal his true self.
And this is how you secure our position? By alienating our patron? By sending half the holy war to its destruction? Trust me, Dunyane, I have fought the Fainim. This holy war, this migration, or whatever it is, has precious little chance of overcoming them as it is, let alone conquering Shaima. And you would cut it in half? By the dead god, you do need me to teach you war, don't you?
Kellis, of course, was unmoved. Alienating Proyas is to our advantage. He judges men harshly, holds all in suspicion. He opens himself only when he's moved to regret, and he will regret. As for Sabon, I told him only what he wanted to hear. Every man yearns to hear their flattering delusions confirmed. Every man. This is why they support, willingly, so many parasitic castes, such as augurs, priests, memorial—
Read my face, dog! Nayor grated. You will not convince me this is a success.
Pause. Shining eyes, blinking, watching. The intimation of a horrifying scrutiny. No, Kellis said. I suppose not. More lies. I didn't, the monk continued, anticipate the others, Gothjelk and Skyelt, would follow his lead. With just the Galioth and the Shrial Knights, I deemed the risk acceptable. The Holy War could survive their loss, and given what you've said regarding the liabilities of unwieldy hosts, I thought it might even profit. But without the Tidoni...
Lies! You would have stopped them otherwise! You could have stopped them if you wished!
Kellis shrugged. Perhaps. But Sauban left us the very night he found us in the hills. He roused his men when he returned and set out before dawn yesterday. Both Gothjelk and Skyelt had already followed him into the Southron gates by the time we returned. It was too late.
You believed him, didn't you? You believed all that tripe about Skores fleeing Gadea? You still believe?
Sauban believed it. I merely think it probable.
As you said,
Nayor snarled with as much spite as he could muster.
Every man yearns to hear their flattering delusions confirmed.
Another pause. First I require one great name, Kellis said. Then the others will follow. If Gadea falls, then Prince Coetha Sauban will turn to me before making any decision of moment. We need this holy war, Skilvendi. I deemed it worth the risk. Such a fool. Nayor regarded Kellis, even though he knew his expression would betray nothing, and his own, everything. He considered lecturing him on the treacherous ways of the Fainim, who invariably used feints and false informants, and who invariably gulled fools like Coetha Sauban. But then he glimpsed Serwe, glaring at him from her corner, her eyes brimming with hatred, accusation, and terror.
This is always the way,
something within him said. Something exhausted. And suddenly he realized that he'd actually believed the Dunyane, believed that he had made a mistake. And yet it was often like this, believing and not believing. It reminded him of listening to old Harut, the Ottomat memorialist who'd taught him his verses as a child. One moment, Nayor would be sweeping across the steppe with a hero like the great Uthgai. The next, he would be staring at a broken old man, drunk on Gishrut, stumbling on phrases 1,000 years old. When one believed, one's soul was moved. When one didn't, everything else moved. Not everything I say, the Dunyane said, can be a lie, Skilvendi. So why do you insist on thinking I deceive you in all things?
Because that way, Nayor grated, you deceive me in nothing.
Riding on the flank to avoid the dust, Nayor glanced at Proyas and his entourage of caste nobles and servants. Despite the luster of their armor and dress, they looked grim. They had negotiated the southern gates through the Unaris, and at long last they rode across heathen land, across Gedea. But their mood was neither jubilant nor assured. 2 days ago, Proyas had sent several advance parties of horsemen to search for Sabon, the Galioth prince. This morning, outriders belonging to Lord Ingaiaban had found one of those parties dead. Gedea, at least in the shadow of the Unaris, was a broken land, a jumble of gravel slopes and stunted promontories. Save for clutches of hardy cedars, the green of spring was growing tawny beneath the summer sun. The sky was a plate of turquoise, featureless, sere, so different from the cloudy depths of Nansur skies. Vultures and jackdaws screeched into the air at their approach. With a curse, Proyas reined to a halt.
"So what does this mean?" he asked Nayor. "That Scorus has somehow positioned himself behind Sabon and the others? Have the Fainim encircled them?"
Nayor raised a hand against the sun.
"Perhaps."
The bodies had been stripped where they'd fallen, some 60 or 70 dead men, bloating in the hot sun, scattered like things dropped in flight. Without warning, Nayor spurred ahead, forcing the prince and his entourage to gallop after him.
"Sodorus was my cousin," Proyas snapped, reining to a violent halt beside him. "My father will be furious."
"Another cousin,"
Lord Ingaiaban said darkly. He referred to Calmomunus and the vulgar holy war. Nayor sniffed the air, contemplated the smell of rot. He'd almost forgotten what it was like, the scribbling flies, the swelling bellies, the eyes like painted cloth. He'd almost forgotten how holy. War. The very earth seemed to tingle. Proyas dismounted and knelt over one of the dead. He waved away flies with his gauntlets. Turning to Nayor, he asked,
"How about you? Do you still believe him?"
He looked away as though embarrassed by the honesty of his tone. Him, Kellis.
"He..."
Nayor paused, spat when he should have shrugged.
"He sees things."
Proyas snorted.
"Your manner does little to reassure me."
He stood, casting his shadow across the dead Cunryan, slapping the dust from the ornamental skirt he wore over his male leggings.
"This is always the way of it, I suppose."
"What do you mean, my prince?"
Zynemus asked.
"We think things will be more glorious than they are, that they'll unfold according to our hopes, our expectations."
He unstopped his water skin, took too long a drink.
"The Nansur actually have a word for it," he continued. "We idealize."
Statements such as this, Nayor had decided, partially explained the awe and adoration Proyas roused in his men, including those who were names in their own right, such as Gaideki and Ingaiaban. The admixture of honesty and insight. Kellis did much the same, didn't he?
"So what do you think?" Proyas was asking. "What happened here?"
He'd clambered back onto his horse.
"Hard to tell,"
Nayor replied, glancing once again over the dead.
"Fah,"
Lord Gaideki snorted.
"Sodorus was no fool. He was overwhelmed by numbers."
Nayor disagreed, but rather than dispute the man, he jerked his horse about and spurred toward the ridge. The soil was sandy, the turf shallow-rooted. His mount, a sleek Cunryan black, stumbled several times before reaching the crest. Here he paused, leaning against his saddle's cantle to relieve a vagrant pain in his back. Before him, the far side sloped gradually down, lending the entire ridge the appearance of a titanic shoulder blade. To the immediate north, the bald heights of the Unada Spur gathered in the haze. Nayor followed the crest a short distance, studying the scuffed ground and counting the dead. 17 more, stripped, like the others, their arms askew, their mouths teeming with flies. The sound of Proyas arguing with his palatines wafted up from below. Proyas was no fool, but his fervor made him impatient. Despite hours of listening to Nayor describe the resources and methods of the Kianin, he as yet possessed no clear understanding of their foe. His countrymen, on the other hand, possessed no understanding whatsoever. And when men who knew little argued with men who knew nothing, tempers were certain to be thrown out of joint. Since the earliest days of the march, Nayor had harbored severe doubts regarding the Holy War and its churlish nobles. So far, nearly every measure he'd suggested in council had been either summarily rejected or openly scoffed at, the yapping fools. In so many ways, the Holy War was the antithesis of a Skilvendi horde. The people brooked few, if any, followers. No pampering slaves, no priests or augurs, and certainly no women, which could always be had when one ranged enemy country. They carried little baggage over what a warrior and his mount could bear, even on the longest campaigns. If they exhausted their amicut and could secure no forage, they either let blood from their mounts or went hungry. Their horses, though small, unbecoming, and relatively slow, were bred to the land, not to the stable. The horse he now rode, a gift from Proyas, not only required grain over and above fodder, but enough to feed 3 men. Madness. The only thing Nayor had not protested was the very thing the dog-eyed idiot ceaselessly clucked and fretted over, the breakup of the Holy War into separate contingents. What was it with these Inrithi? Did brothers bed their sisters? Did they beat their children about the head? The larger the host, the slower the march. The slower the march, the more supplies the host consumed. It was that simple. The problem wasn't that the Holy War had divided. It simply had no choice. Gadea, by all accounts, was a lean country, scarcely cultivated and sparsely populated. The problem was that it had done so without planning, without advance intelligence of what to expect, without agreed upon routes or secure communications. But how to make them understand? And understand they must. The Holy War survival depended on it. Everything depended on it. Nayor spat across the dust, listened to them bicker, watched them gesticulate. Murdering Anasarimba Moengus was all that mattered. It was the weight that drew all lines plumb.
Any indignity. Anything. Loading Gaiaban!
Nayor called down, startling them into silence.
Ride back to the main column and return with at least 100 of your men. The Fainim are fond of surprising those who come to dispense with the dead.
When none of the milling nobles moved, Nayor cursed and urged his horse back down the slope. Proyas scowled as he approached, but said nothing.
He tests me. I care not if you think me impertinent, Nayor said. I speak only of what must be done.
I'll go,
Zynemus offered, already drawing his horse around.
No,
Nayor said.
Lord Ingaiaban goes.
Ingaiaban grunted, ran fingers over the blue sparrows embroidered across his surcoat, the sign of his house. He glared at Nayor.
Of all the dogs who've dared piss on my leg, he said, you're the first to aim higher than my knee.
Several guffaws broke from the others, and the Count Palatine of Cathente grinned bitterly.
But before I change my leggings, Skilvendi, please tell me why you choose to piss on me.
Nayor wasn't amused.
Because your household is the closest. Because the life of your prince is at stake.
The lantern-jawed Palatine paled.
Do as he bids,
Zynemus cried.
Watch yourself, Marshal, Ingaiaban snarled. Playing Benjuka with our prince doesn't make you my better.
Which means, then, Lord Gaideki quipped, that you must piss no higher than his waist.
Another burst of laughter, and Gaiaban ruefully shook his head. He paused before riding off, dipping his square-bearded chin to Skilvendi, but, whether in conciliation or warning, the Skilvendi couldn't tell. An uncomfortable pause followed. The shadow of a vulture flickered across the group, and Proyas glanced skyward.
So, Nayor, he said, blinking away the sun, what happened here? Were they overwhelmed by numbers?
Nayor scowled.
They were outwitted, not outnumbered.
How do you mean? Proyas asked.
Your cousin was a fool. He was accustomed to riding with his men in file, as horsemen must when using a road. They wound into this depression and began climbing the slope, some 3 or 4 abreast. The Kianin waited for them above, holding their horses to the ground.
They were ambushed.
Proyas raised a hand to better peer along the ridgeline. Do you think the heathen simply happened on them? Nayor shrugged.
Perhaps not.
Since Adoris thought himself an outrider, he obviously saw no need to deploy scouts of his own. The Phaenom are more canny. They could have tracked him for some time without his knowledge, judged that sooner or later he would come here.
He brought his horse about and pointed to the group of bloating dead who littered the center of the ridgeline. They looked oddly peaceful, like eunuchs snoozing in the sun after bathing.
But this is moot. The Phaenom attacked when the first men crested the ridge, Sidorus among them.
How in hell,
Lord Gaideki blurted,
could you know whether— Because the horsemen below broke ranks to rush to their lord's defense, only to find the Phaenom arrayed along the entire ridgeline. Though it looks harmless, that slope is treacherous, sand and gravel. Many were slain by arrows at close range as their horses floundered. Those few who gained the summit caused the Phaenom quite some grief. I saw far more blood than bodies up there, but were eventually overwhelmed. The rest, some 20 or so, more sober but hopelessly courageous men, realized the futility of saving their lord and pulled back. There, perhaps intending to draw the Phaenom down and exact some revenge.
Neyur glanced at Gaideki, daring the brash Palatine to contradict him. But the man studied the disposition of the dead like the others.
The Kianin, Neyur continued, remained on the crest. They taunted the survivors, I think, by desecrating Sidorus's corpse. Someone was disemboweled. Then they tried to reduce your kinfolk with archery. Those Inrithi who fought them on the crest must have unnerved them, because they were taking no chances. Their arrows must have possessed little effect even at that short range. At some point, they began shooting their horses, something the Kianin are typically loath to do. This is something to remember. Once Sidorus's men were unhorsed, the Kianin simply rode them down.
War. The hairs rose on the nape of his neck.
They stripped the bodies, he added, then rode off to the southwest.
Neyur wiped his palms across his thighs. The fools believed him. That much was plain from their stunned silence. Before, this place had been a rebuke and a dread omen, but now, mystery made things titanic. Knowledge made small.
Sweet Sejanus,
Gaideki suddenly exclaimed.
He reads the dead like scripture.
Proyas frowned at the man.
No blasphemy, please, Lord Palatine.
He scratched his trim beard, his gaze wandering yet again over the dead. He seemed to be nodding. He fixed Neyur with a canny look. How many?
Phaenom,
the Skilvendi shrugged.
60, maybe 70, lightly armored horsemen, no more.
And Sabon? Does this mean he's encircled?
Neyur matched his gaze.
When one wars on foot against horse, one is always encircled.
So the bastard may still live,
Proya said, his breathlessness betrayed by a faint quaver in his voice. The Holy War could survive the loss of one nation, but three? Sabon had gambled more than his own life on this rash gambit, far more, which was why Proyas, over Confis's protestations, had ordered his people to march. Perhaps four nations could prevail where three could not.
For all we know, Zynemus said, the Galioth bastard may be right. He could be fanning across Gadea as we speak, chasing Scaurus's skirmishers to the sea.
No,
Neyur said,
his peril is great. Scaurus has assembled in Gadea. He awaits you with all his might.
And how could you know that?
Gaideki cried.
Because the Phaenom who killed your kinsmen took a great risk.
Proyas nodded, his eyes at once narrow and apprehensive. They attacked a larger and more heavily armed force, which means they were following orders, strict orders, to prevent any communication between isolated contingents. Neyur lowered his head in deference. Not to the man, but to the truth. At long last, Nersei Proyas was beginning to understand. Scaurus had been watching, studying the Holy War since long before it had left Momem's walls. He knew its weaknesses. Knowledge. It all came down to knowledge. Moengus had taught him that.
War is intellect, the Skilvendi chieftain said. So long as you and your people insist on waging it with your hearts, you are doomed. Akiria Imval!
1,000 Galioth throats boomed.
Akiria Imval Pavalsa!
Glory to the god. Glory to the god of gods. Startled from his reverie, Koitha Sawbon looked down over the great, haphazard column that was his army, searching for some sign of Kusalt, his groom, who'd ridden out to meet the scouts. He gnawed at his calloused knuckles, as he always did when he was anxious. Please, he thought, please. But there was no sign. Pulling helm and coif from his head, he ran his fingers through his short, autumn-blonde hair, squeezing out the sweat that kept nagging his eyes. He sat astride his horse, alone on a promontory overlooking a small but fast-running river, not marked on any of his crude maps. Thankfully, the river was fordable, though not without difficulty. It had already claimed 4 wains in 1 life, as well as several precious hours. The valley was growing more and more congested as men and supplies gathered behind the ford. On the far side, warriors and followers alike shook water from their limbs, then fanned out, some following the banks to refill water skins, or, Sawbon noted darkly, even to fish. Others trudged onward, their faces bovine with weariness, their packs swinging from pikes and spears. To the south, the towering ridges that had everywhere obscured his view folded into the river vale, revealing the hazy contours of what was to come. There, beyond the failing hills, he could see it, a broad plain, blue with distance, reaching as far as the horizon, the plains of Mengeta, the great battle plain of legend. His chest tightened. He thought of his older cousin, Tharshilka, whose bones moldered with those of Kalmamunis and the vulgar holy war among those distant grasses. He thought of Prince Kellis. I own this land. It belongs to me. It must. They'd marched for an entire week, through the passes of the southern gates, then along a ruined Canaan road which had inexplicably ended in a ravine. Here he and Gothyelk, the stubborn old bastard, had quarreled to the point of fisticuffs over which way they should continue. The jewel of Gedea, if it could be called such, was the city of Hinnereth to the southeast on the Menenor coast. Sawbon wanted the city for himself, certainly, but the Holy War needed it to secure their flank as they continued south. For the great Hoga Gothyelk, however, Gedea was something to be crossed, not conquered. The fool spoke as though the lands between the Holy War and Shima were nothing more than strides on a sprinter's track. They'd bellowed at each other deep into the night, with Gotian trying time and again to find some common ground, and Scaled, nodding off in his corner, pretending now and then to listen to his interpreter. In the end, they resolved to go their separate ways. Gotian, who, like all Nansur caste nobles, had a thorough military education, elected to continue on to Hinnereth. He was no fool, at least. No one knew what Scaled intended until the following day, when he struck southward with Gothyelk and his Tidoni. Good riddance, Sawbon had thought. At the time, he'd still believed that Scorus had yielded Gedea. March, the Prince of Atrathau had said that night in the mountains. The whore will be kind to you. Just make certain the Shrial Knights are punished. Never in his life had Sawbon obsessed so long over so few words. They'd seemed straightforward enough at the time, but like those eerie ancient non-men statues that looked benevolent or malicious, divine or demonic, depending upon where one stood, their meaning transformed with every passing day. Had Prince Kellis, in fact, confirmed his beliefs? The gods had given their assurances, certainly, and, like the misers they were, they'd named their terms. But they'd said nothing about Scorus yielding Gedea. If anything, they had suggested the opposite. Battle. They suggested battle. How else was he to punish the Shrial Knights?
Akiria Imval! Akiria Imval!
Sawbon glanced down for an instant, then resumed probing the southern horizon, the battle plain. Flat, dark, and blue, it looked more an ocean than a great table of earth, like something that could swallow nations whole. Scorus hadn't relinquished Gedea. He could feel it, like lead in his belly and bones. This realization, coming as it did hard on the heels of his feud with Gothyelk, had filled Sawbon with terror, so much so that he'd refused to countenance it at first. He possessed the assurances of the gods. The gods! What did it matter whether he marched with Gothyelk and his Tidoni or no? The whore would be kind to him. Gedea would be his. So he told himself. Then, from nowhere, an inner voice had whispered, Perhaps Prince Kellis is a fraud. Such was the madness of things, the perversity, that one thought, one slight twitch of the soul could overturn so much. Where before he need only collect the future like a tax farmer, now he threw number sticks against the great black, for the lives of thousands, no less, perhaps for the entire holy war. One thought, so frail was the balance between soul and world. Dread overcame him, threatened him with despair. At night, he wept in the secrecy of his tent. Was this not always the way? Hadn't the gods always taunted, frustrated, and humiliated him? First, the fact of his birth, to be the first soul in the body of the seventh son. Then his father, who'd punished him beyond all reason, beat him for possessing his fire, his cunning. Then the wars against the Nansorium a few years previous. Mere miles. So close he could see the smear of Momem's smoke on the horizon, only to be afflicted by Ikuri Confis, to be bested by a stripling. And now this. Why cheat him? Hadn't he given? Hadn't he observed their petty statutes, slaked their obscene thirst for blood? Then yesterday, both Athgieri and Wainhale, whom Sauban had charged with scouting and securing the country in advance of the main body, had sighted large parties of heathen horsemen. Many colored, with thin flowing coats, Wainhale, the Earl of Curragald, had said at evening council. Despite their similar age and stature, Wainhale always struck Sauban as one of those men flung far from their natural station by the happenstance of birth, a tavern clown in the trappings of a caste noble. Worse than the Enona, even. Like a troop of fucking dancers. There was a chorus of laughter. But fast, Athgieri had added, his gaze fixed upon the fire. Very fast. When he looked to the others, his expression was stern, his long-lashed eyes sober. When we gave chase, they outstripped us with ease. He paused so the assembled earls and thanes could digest the significance of this. And their archery? I've never seen the like. Somehow, they can draw and release while they ride, fire backward at their pursuers. The assembled warlords were unimpressed. Inrithi caste nobles, Norserai or Ketje, thought archery base and unmanly. Regarding the sightings themselves, the preponderance of opinion was that they meant little.
Of course they shadow us, Wainhale argued. The only surprise is that we haven't seen the bungbangers before now.
Even Gotian agreed, though with somewhat more decorum.
If Scarus wished to contest Gedea, he said, then he would have defended the passes, no?
Only Athgieri dissented. Afterward, he pulled Sauban aside and fairly hissed.
Something's amiss, uncle.
Something was amiss, though Sauban had said nothing at the time. He'd learned long ago the virtue of suspending judgment in the company of his commanders, especially in situations where his authority was uncertain. Even though he could count on many men, mostly relatives or veterans of his previous campaigns, he was really only the titular head of the Galeoth contingent, a fact brought home by the number of caste nobles who continually gambled through the hills, hunting or hawking. The deference owed by earls to a Lackland prince was largely ceremonial. His every command, it seemed, had to run a gauntlet of pride and whimsy. So he pretended to deliberate, concealed the certainty that weighed so heavy against him, concealed the truth. They were alone, some 40 or 50,000 Galeoth and under 9,000 Shrial Knights, not to mention the uncounted thousands who followed, stranded in hostile country, wandering into the clutches of a ruthless, cunning, and determined foe. Gothyelk and his Tidoni were lost. Proyas and Confis remained camped about Asgiliac. They were vastly outnumbered, if the estimates of Scorus's strength provided by Confis could be trusted, and Gotian insisted they could. They had no real discipline, no real leader, and they had no sorceress, no scarlet spires.
But he said the whore would be kind. He said.
Sauban puzzled at the chorus of voices that continued to reverberate from below.
Akiria Imval!
Usually a patchwork of shouts, chants, and hymns characterized the march. Something had incited them. Once again, Sauban peered through the dust and masked men, searching for some sign of his groom. It had to be Kusalt.
Please. There,
Riding with a small party of horsemen, Sabon released a deep, shuddering breath, watched them pass through a screen of cheering men-at-arms, Agmundermen by the look of their teardrop shields, before climbing the gravel incline to join him. His relief quickly evaporated. They bore lances, he realized, lances capped with severed heads.
Akiria Imval Pavalsa!
Sabon clenched a fist, beat it against a mail-covered thigh. With thumb and forefinger, he pinched a glimpse of Prince Kellis from his eyes.
No one knows you.
Lances. They bore lances, a traditional token used by Galeoth knights to warn their commanders of imminent battle.
From Athtieri,
he called out as Kusalt's horse gained the crest. The old groom scowled, as though to say,
who else?
Everything about the man was dull. His mail, his ancient, dented battle cap, even the red lion on blue of his surcoat, which marked him as a member of the House Coithus. Dull and dangerous. Kusalt cared nothing for his appearance, and this made him appear all the more formidable. There was much violence in that grizzled face. The only man Sabon had ever met with eyes as implacable as Kusalt's had been Prince Kellis.
What does he say?
Sabon cried. The old groom tossed the lance before reining to a halt. Sabon snatched it, almost too late. He found himself face to face with a severed head planted on its tip, dark skin blanched and bloodless, the braids of its goatee swaying, a Kianine noble possessing the leathery look of dead things left over long in the sun. Even still, it seemed to gaze at him, slack and heavy-lidded, like a man about to spill his seed. His foe.
War and apples, Kusalt said. He said, war and apples.
Apples was common slang for decapitated heads among the Galeoth. In days of yore, a tutor had once told Sabon, the Galeoth had stewed and stuffed them, like the Thunieri. The others rumbled to the summit, hailing him. Gotian with the second Sarcellus, Anferig, the Earl of Gaisendal, with his groom. Several thanes, representatives of different households, and four or five beardless adolescents ready to courier messages. With the exception of Kusalt and Gotian, everyone carried a look somewhere between desperation and exasperation. The ensuing argument was as bitter as any Sabon had endured since parting ways with Gothjalk. Apparently, Athgieri and Wainhale had been fighting running battles since early morning. Athgieri in particular, Kusalt said, was convinced that Scaurus assembled nearby, most likely on the plains of Mengeta.
He thinks the Sapatashah is trying to slow us with his pickets, keep us from reaching the battle plain until he's prepared.
But Gotian disagreed, insisting that Scaurus had prepared long ago, that he was actually trying to bait them.
He knows your people are rash, that the promise of battle will bring them running.
When Anferig and the others began protesting, the Grand Master screeched,
don't you see? Don't you see?
Over and over until everyone, including Sabon, fell silent.
He wants to engage you as soon as possible on favorable ground, as soon as possible.
So?
Anferig asked contemptuously. Whether directly or indirectly, Gotian was always lecturing them on the cunning and ferocity of the Fainim. As a result, many of the Gallio thought he feared the heathen, thought he was craven, when what he truly feared, Sabon knew, was the reckless humor of his Norserai allies.
So, perhaps he knows something we don't, something that necessitates closing with us quickly.
The word struck Sabon breathless.
If Cadia is a broken country, he said numbly, then the battle plain would be the quickest means of crossing it.
He glanced at Gotian, who nodded cautiously.
What does...
Anferig started.
Think,
Sabon exclaimed.
Think, Anfi, think.
Gothjalk. If Gothjalk wishes to cross Gadia as quickly as possible, what path would he take?
The Earl of Gaisendal was no fool, but then neither was he a prodigy. He lowered his graying leonine head in concentration, then said,
you're saying he's close, that the Tidoni and Thunieri have been marching parallel to us this entire time, making for the battle plain as we do?
When he looked up, his eyes were bright with grudging admiration. As a close mead friend of his oldest brother, Anferig, Sabon knew, had always looked on him as the boy he'd so roundly teased in his youth.
You're saying the Sapatashah is trying to prevent us from joining Gothjalk?
Exactly, Sabon replied. He glanced at Gotian once again, realized the Grand Master had given him this insight.
He wants me to lead, trusts me.
But then the man didn't know him. No one did. No one.
What are these thoughts?
Save the Einanni, the Taidoni comprised the largest contingent of the Holy War, some 70,000 hard-bitten men. Add to that Scald's murderous 20,000, and they possessed nearly all the might of the Middle North, the greatest Norserai host since the fall of the ancient North.
Ah, Skardus, my heathen friend.
Suddenly the severed head upon the lance no longer seemed a rebuke, a totem of their doom. It seemed a sign, the smoke that promised cleansing fire. With unaccountable certainty, Sabon realized that Skardus was afraid. As well he should be. His misapprehensions fell away, and the old exhilaration coursed like liquor through his veins, a sensation he had always attributed to Gilgeol, One-Eyed War. The whore will be kind to you. Sabon tossed the lance and its grisly trophy back to Kusalt, then began barking orders, dispatching multiple messengers to inform Athgieri and Wainhale of the situation, charging Anfrig with the attempt to locate Gothjalk, bidding Gotian to send his knights throughout the column, urging restraint and discipline.
Until we rejoin Gothjalk, we remain in the hills, he declared. If Skardus wishes to close with us, either let him fight on foot or break 1,000 necks.
Then, suddenly, he found himself alone with Kusalt, his ears buzzing, his face flushed. It was happening, he realized. It was beginning. After years and months, the womanish war of words was finally over, and the real war was beginning. The others, like Froyas, had yearned to untangle the holy in holy war from the Emperor's knots, not Sabon. It was the war he was most interested in. This was what he told himself anyway. And not only was it was happening the way Prince Kellis had said it would.
No one knows you. No one.
He glanced at the retreating forms of Gotian and Sarcellus as they thudded down the slope. The thought of sacrificing them, as Prince Kellis or the gods had demanded, suddenly deadened his heart. Punish them. You must make sure the Shrial Knights are punished. Something cold caught his throat, and as quickly as Gilgeol had possessed him, the god fled.
Is something wrong, my lord?
Kusalt asked. It was uncanny the way the man could guess his moods. But then, he'd always been there. Sabon's earliest childhood memory was of Kusalt scooping him up into his arms and racing into the galleries of Moreor after a bee sting had nearly choked him. Without realizing, Sabon resumed chewing on his knuckles.
Kusalt.
Yes.
Sabon hesitated, found himself looking away to the south, to the battle plain.
I need a copy of the tractate. I need to search for something.
What do you need to know?
The old groom said, his voice both shocked and curiously tender. Sabon glared at him.
What business?
I ask only because I carry the tractate with me always.
His chapped hand had wandered to his chest as he spoke. He laid his palm flat across his heart.
Here.
He'd memorized it, Sabon realized. For some reason, this shocked him to the point of becoming faint. He'd always known Kusalt to be pious, and yet...
Kusalt,
he began, but could think of nothing to say. Those old, implacable eyes blinked, nothing more.
I need...
Sabon finally ventured.
I need to know what the latter prophet has to say regarding sacrifice.
The groom's bushy white brows knitted together.
Many things. Very many things. I don't understand.
What the gods demand? Is it proper because they demand it?
No,
Kusalt said, still frowning. For some reason, the thoughtless certainty of this answer angered him. What did the old fool know?
You disbelieve me,
Kusalt said, his voice thick with weariness.
But it's the glory of Inrisij...
Enough of this prattle!
Coithus Sobon snapped. He glanced at the severed head, at the apple, noticed the glint of a golden incisor between slack and battered lips.
So this was their enemy.
Drawing his sword, he struck it from the lance, and the lance from Kusalt's fist.
I believe what I need to, he grated.